Hello, everyone, and welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast that is going to be going to its happy place because 2021 remains a hellfire. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanagieser. And wait, you think 2021's bad? Come on, Dave. The Olympics are happening. No one can watch them, which is probably a great comfort to all those people who got their houses bulldozed. Okay, I see what you mean. But we're not an Olympics podcast or a topical news podcast. Dave, who are we, and what are we doing with everybody's time?
Why, this is Filmstrips, the podcast in which each and every week we usually take a look at a film, look at the nuance, the subtext, the paratext, spoil the ever-loving hell out of it. But the important thing is that each and every film under discussion must somehow connect back to the film we were discussing upon the preceding week. Having said that, you've probably recognized at this point that we are in the midst of a phase of bonus episodes right now where we've sort of temporarily abandoned the gimmick. It's going to come back. Don't worry about that. That's the case.
Yes. Everyone at home, don't worry. You will get closure on where we could possibly go after seeing Alan Arkin in Inspector Clouseau.
Yes, yes. Catch 22 is coming. And you know what? I'll just spoil it right ahead. We're going to be covering Wolf after that. You know, the Jack Nicholson film with James Spader and Michelle Pfeiffer.
James Spader's in that? I haven't watched it yet. I remember seeing the cover of it at the video store all the time, being like, this looks kind of cheap.
Well, I'll put it to you this way. I mean, David Hyde Pierce is also in the film, so you have that to look forward to. Yeah, it is a film where I see 100% what Mike Nichols is trying to do, and it's also a very good sign without spoiling your conversation in advance about why auteur filmmakers who usually make quote-unquote high drama are not necessarily the best suited for when it comes time to film things like shoot action sequences, monster effects, and other things of that sort. But we'll get there.
Yeah. I mean, like, I feel like he's often kind of slept on, but Ridley Scott may be, like, one of the better versions of that when you look at the filmography.
It could be.
I guess I thought that was going to start a discussion and clearly wasn't. But yeah, all that to say is as we're winding down the summer, some people don't have a lot going on. Well, I don't know about our man David, but I certainly do have a lot going on. And, you know, we've been doing this podcast for close to 3 years, and while we have always tried our very best to bring you a new episode each and every week, sometimes it's probably a little bit better to focus on maintaining one's sanity, taking breaks as needed, and as Dave noted off the top, remembering to go to your happy place. And sometimes the easiest way to do that is remember that watching movies before it becomes, a critical talking point, or before it becomes the impetus for you to have a Letterboxd account, or before it becomes the gimmick that you then monetize and never have to work in an office again. Watching movies is fun. And sometimes it's nice to reflect on that basic principle and reconnect to that, because the moment that your hobbies feel like work, maybe it's a sign course correction that's needed. Dave, do you remember that weird, like, online debate between noted film historian, literally the man who wrote the book on film studies, David Bordwell, and Slavoj Žižek?
I can't say that I did, but I'm already anticipating what this could actually have been in this instance.
Yeah, I forget exactly what it was, but Bordwell was basically responding to something that Žižek had written. And for those of you, you might remember Žižek as the guy who sniffles a lot. But Žižek is more of like sort of the broader cultural theorist, as opposed to a film scholar or anything like that. It's an interesting back and forth, and Bordwell more or less de-pantses him by the end, and like has a final rebuttal where it's just point-by-point breakdown, and then it ends with him remarking that it's like, however, even Žižek's detractors will admit one thing. Say what you will about the man, but he really does genuinely enjoy movies, to which I say, who doesn't? Movies are terrific! You know, and especially being in places like Twitter, it seems like movies are seen first and foremost as argument fodder. And I think we really kind of lose sight of what makes them so enjoyable in the first place.
Yeah, the culture war has ruined a lot of things and taking many casualties amongst the civilians in the process here. But I mean, the key thing here is you're absolutely right. I mean, films should be a fun thing. Like, I mean, and that's the key thing. When I say fun, I don't mean that necessarily everybody has to like a film or can't criticize it or anything like that. But I mean, if you're not getting any joy out of the conversation, that why are you participating?
Yeah, Marie Kondo style. Simplify some things, right? Like, and I mean, when we say fun, that certainly doesn't necessarily have to mean something facile, right? I mean, some
Yeah.
people have fun at doing Sudoku puzzles. Some people have fun playing Call of Duty, right? There are different ways one can have fun. The important thing is to occasionally recenter yourself and think, well, what are my tastes and what do I want out of a film object?
If you're my nephew, it's Godzilla. That's it. That's really all he wants out of a film right now. King Kong is also acceptable there, but really, if it doesn't have one of those two components right now, it's kind of screwed for him. We're hitting upon the age of the transforming robot as he's recently discovered, and I live in constant fear. But
Remember
we'll
when we
put that
watched
aside.
that Godzilla movie, and because I acquired a copy through unofficial means, it didn't have subtitles, so I watched a 2-hour live-action Godzilla movie that was all about bureaucratic inefficiency, and I had no idea what was going on. That was fun. And then we watched Evangelion, where I surprisingly did understand what was going on.
Yeah, well, hey, well, that's what, a lifetime of fandom will get you with that one. I'm sure it's kind of like what, showing, Doctor Who, the 1996 TV movie, to people who have never seen an episode of Doctor Who before. This is what it's like. I fully understand it. You probably have no clue what's happening.
A
But,
lifetime ago, as a Christmas gift to David on the previous podcast, 24 Panels, we actually decided to give Dave a Christmas gift by sitting down and each of us would watch a different Doctor Who Christmas special. I got Peter Capaldi and he was hanging out with Santa Claus, who I think was played by Nick Frost,
he was
which I
indeed.
guess makes sense because, winter.
Yeah.
I remember it not being bad, but apparently there was a big emotional catharsis moment, and I'm like, oh, I didn't realize that guy was dead because I haven't watched the last 7 seasons of this show.
Well, you would have only needed to go back one season for that, but that's the your point still stands. That was also an episode that never was released because it ended in disaster, with most people wondering what, where Drew did everything in his power to basically subvert and undermine the whole premise of what the episode was, despite being the one to suggest it, right from
Oh,
the get-go.
yeah, the Christmas episode that wasn't.
Yeah, that
Man, we
was.
have a lot of lore considering that considering that all our show has ever been is you and I sitting down once a week to talk about movies.
Nah, it builds up after time, so stay tuned for the Saint McDonough special, which
Oh,
will come up one of these days.
yes, one day we'll have to actually update the website. Remember when we had that for a while? Kids, it's important to plan out your projects in advance, and it's
Choices
also
were made, with regards to that, yeah.
I don't know. I think we found a lot of very appropriate public access interjects to tie into episodes, and that was before a longtime friend of the show, Ross May, discovered his inner talent for within seconds of a new episode being posted, being able to find a Simpsons screen grab that somehow ties into it.
Yeah, and he hasn't missed a one yet. No, even when we do random, literally, well, we had an episode that was 1 minute long and me explaining why there wasn't an episode this week, and he still had one on the go.
Yeah,
So.
it's uncanny. Like, I almost feel like it's Ross May's world and we're just living in it.
So what you're saying in this case, Andrew, is that really all the deaths that we are responsible for are Russ's fault.
That's true. Or maybe it's like that Twilight Zone classic, which was also in the movie, the one that killed Vic Morrow, where we all have to think happy thoughts. Because if we stop, well, then all of a sudden we're going to get turned into Jack in the Boxes or something.
So usually when we hit the point of a Simpsons reference, which itself is a Twilight Zone reference, we now need to come back to probably what the central object of this episode is, and that is films that make us happy. Let's go back to the happy place here. And Andrew, let's start with you. What would be your happy place films in this instance?
Well, I guess maybe a few more words on that. Because I think it's important to realize that, you know, we often view films hierarchically as what is the best movie ever made? Or when someone says, what's your favorite film? Often I feel like we hear that question as, what do you think the best film ever made is? But like, I mean, I know what I can tell you what I think some of the best films ever made are, but I'll also admit that they're not films I want to watch all the time. Like, there's certainly films like, Gaspar Noé's Irreversible that come to mind that I think are incredibly powerful, very, very daring, and by design, incredibly confrontational. And I think they actually do succeed, while at the same time saying, I absolutely never want to see that film ever again. Whereas, you know, there's also the bias the other way, where it's like, well, any film that's appealing to people or makes you laugh can't be that good. Like, we recently saw in The In-Laws that is a note-perfect example of how an incredibly fun movie can also be incredibly good, you know? I've said it before, but, like, how, I'm certainly, I have a certain sort of disdain for what I call Christopher Nolan syndrome, which is, I would much rather watch a dumb film that knows what it is and has fun with that than a pretty middling film that thinks it's a masterpiece. And I have been thinking about this question a lot, about, like, what's a happy movie for me, like a feel-good movie, or a film that I can always put on and want to watch it? And there is, you're probably going to be surprised at what that film is, and peek behind the curtain. It is a film that you and I are going to be looking at in the coming months, and that is Curtis Hanson's L.A. Confidential.
Yes, so, which, yeah, admittedly, is not necessarily one that when you think of watching, you know, necessarily going, it's like, yep, that's a, you know, a feel-good movie if there ever was one. It's a film, it's a dark movie, but it is one hell of an entertaining one. You're absolutely right.
Well, yeah, and like, I remember, it also has a bit of a special place in my cinephilic memory, because I remember seeing it 1997 after it was on VHS, and I would have been 11, 12 years old at that time, and I remember sitting down and watching it, being like, wow, this is the first, like, grown-up movie I've been able to see. But also, like, over the years, you know, because I remember being a kid and loving, like, Felix the Cat the movie, believing that the Duke of Zill truly was boss, and other things lost to time, being like, wow, this is the greatest movie ever, and quickly growing out of that. There were also times where it's like, no, I'm pretty sure Annie Hall is the best American film ever made. And, you know, like, favorites come and favorites go. L.A. Confidential is one of those rare films, though, that I appreciate just as much, if not more, every single time I watch it. And because it's such a well-structured and well-paced and just well-done film, like, there's never a point where I'm not in the mood to watch it. If it's on, I'll watch, you know, I'll certainly pick it up and keep watching. If I don't have a lot of time, I'm going to watch The Interrogation of Sugar Ray, because I can quote that almost verbatim, because I was that kind of a high schooler. And, you know, it's also, that was kind of a gateway point, because that also was what got me into James Ellroy, who has since become one of my favorite novelists. You know, it's just, they don't make them like they used to. And granted, I don't think I've watched it since the Kevin Spacey allegations came out, but even if I do have to rewatch it, spoiler alert, Vincennes, as Sid Huggins says, goes on the night train to the big adios before the third act even starts. So, you know, it's Again, I think it speaks to me as a viewer and my appreciation of clockwork films, where you put all the pieces that you need together and then you just watch them run off of one another, and there's something very satisfying about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and I mean that I completely agree with you on that one. I
And
mean
there will
that's
probably be
certainly.
more to come to mind as we talk, and seeing as we're probably going to be looking at that one in full soon, I don't really want to say much more than that. Instead, Dave, I know that you've also been thinking on this topic. What would you say is a feel-good favorite for you?
Anybody who knows me knows that one of my all-time favorite films is Ghostbusters, and I do love that one. However, having said that, if I'm ever feeling blue or I just want to be in a good mood, Ghostbusters 2 is my go-to one here. And look, let me be clear. I am well aware of all the criticisms of that movie. I know it's a retread of the first one there. I know structurally, beat for beat, that's the case. It's also a film that is basically built around hanging out with a bunch of characters you really, 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 really like. And honestly, that movie is just so generally good-natured in what it's aiming to do. And I mean, yeah, some of the metaphors in that are a bit on the nose. Mood slime that's built up out of the negative forces of New York energy and the need for people to be happy in order to sort of bring it together. I don't care. I get excited to, the millionth time watching the Statue of Liberty walk through, the bay to get into New York proper and then walk down the streets as everybody all of New York cheers it on. Is
I
it
don't know if
ridiculous?
I've ever actually seen Ghostbusters 2. I'm not like that. I know I have seen the first one at a bunch of different times, but like that never connected with me as a youth. So that's why it was all the more strange when the Lady Ghostbusters came out and then everyone was screaming about how like their childhood was destroyed simply because like I don't have that connection. But yeah, what I do recall though is that everybody loves Ghostbusters and not nearly as many people love Ghostbusters 2.
See, and that's my thing. I love Ghostbusters too. I, like I said, I'm part of it is that, yeah, I have a bit of rose-colored glasses. I saw this in the theater at the age of 5, which is basically the perfect age to see it. I also will argue it's legitimately a creepier movie than the first one is in many regards here. Like, there is stuff that straight up is scary in that film, particularly when you're that young. But just there's so much joy and fun that to be had in it. Even if Bill Murray himself wasn't experiencing that on set, or most of anybody involved with the making of it, there, I like it really does put me into a happy place. And for a number of New Year's Eves in a row, yeah, that was the film I would watch on New Year's Eve, to ring in the new year. Because yes, the film is set on New Year's Eve, on the turning of 1989 into 1990. So,
Whoa!
yeah, there we go.
Once
So
they invent
I
computers, they're gonna have to fix their clocks.
indeed. Well, hey, they do talk about the millennium in that movie there, and why Viggo the Carpathian is back, and why he wants to possess a baby in this instance. It's,
Okay, so Gozar the Traveler is number one, and Viggo the
yes.
Carpathian is number two.
Yes, Viggo the Carpathian, the demon-possessed painting, is yes from number two.
Okay.
So, highly recommend checking that out. And like I said, as well, I will say this: I defend Ghostbusters 2016. The people who dislike it, I'm not going to claim it's a perfect film, but it's highly enjoyable. But that would be my first Happy Place film. What about you, Andrew? I mean, you noted that you probably had several in you in this instance.
Well, I mean, typically, almost anything with Peter Falk seems to be good, but then I start remembering Machine Gun McCain. I would say in recent years, a film that we haven't had the opportunity to look at yet in our timeline, but a film that certainly was it was every now and then there is a film that comes out that gets such a glowing response that I'm almost afraid to see it because I feel like it can't live up to it. It took me a long time to actually sit down and watch Into the Spider-Verse,
Yes.
and I kick myself for waiting as long as I did. And it's not just because it's a film that I watch with my children and they love, and not just because it is, because when I was a kid, like the Spider-Man animated series was very foundational and formative to me. Like, honestly, setting aside the fact, like, not, it's not just a great animated film, it is a high watermark for what superhero films can be. I think it's absolutely fascinating at the level of visual design and at the level of animated technique, sort of the way that it uses the medium to tell its story. It's not just neat, but like it is so layered in its detail that it is well worth holding up over repeat viewings. But like it is so surprisingly emotive in some of the subtlest ways that you don't see it coming until you're crying into your sink because you told your kids that you had to make sure that the burners were off on the stove. Like we previously looked at Richard Donner's Superman, and we talked about how there is something just so lovely and inspiring about it, because this is a film being made with the idea that what would the heroes that we read about, what would that look like on screen? Who would they be if we were to meet them in real life? Imagining that better world and that better version of the self in that. And I feel like there's a very similar, almost a yearning for genuine heroes, that's sort of like the emotional beating heart of Into the Spider-Verse. And like, it has so many tremendous set pieces. It's funny. The voice cast is incredible. It's just it comes together so brilliantly that, I mean, that is the kind of film that I would easily offer to somebody who says that they don't like animated film, they don't like superhero media. It's less bonkers than Batman Ninja, but I think in many respects, though, it really is a high watermark for the genre.
No, absolutely. I mean, it really is a high thing. And again, that's why I'm a little concerned about the sequel, because it now has a high bar to hit coming up with that. But if they can pull it off, I'm more power to them. I want to see more Miles Morales adventures.
Yeah. And I mean, on paper, like, when I heard about the first one, I'm like, so you're making a Spider-Man film without Spider-Man. How's this gonna work? And every now and then, like, I think it's safe to say, and longtime listeners would probably agree, that I'm probably a lot more cynical than Dave is. But at the same time, nothing ever makes me as happy as being proven wrong.
So prove us wrong, Into the Spider-Verse 2. Prove us wrong. Simpsons quote number two. Yes. On my note, to go from to a completely different thing, there's one film that if I'm ever miserable or unhappy, I can always put on, and for 75 minutes will cheer me up like nobody's business. And that is the one, the only, the magnificent Mystery Science Theater 3000, the movie. Yes, the feature film version of the television series Mystery Science Theater 3000, in which they work their way through the film This Island Earth. And this was my introduction to Mystery Science Theater 3000, and it is like literally, this is still one of my all-time favorite stories that goes with this film, because I was working at a funeral home in 2000 when I caught this film. It was playing on City TV as their lead-up to Halloween at that point in time. So I watched it, not being, it's like, oh yeah, I've heard about this. I have never seen it before. We'll see what it's like, and had a blast watching the whole thing. I tracked a copy of it about a month later on VHS down. And the people who were around in 2000, you might know, in the southern part of Ontario, we had one hell of a rainstorm come down on us at that point, which led to flooding in my area, including my parents' basement. So this meant that for a while, five people were all living in the upstairs of a house with all the stuff that they could salvage brought upstairs as well. that makes for tight living, as you can imagine, while construction's going on to restore the basement at this point. My younger brother, you know, I wanted to watch this thing. I had a VHS and a small TV hooked up in my room, and he joined me, and we watched it. He had a ball watching it. He ended up talking my sister into watching it there, so I put the tape back in another time, and all three of us watched it. She was gung-ho about it. She then turned around and her and my brother ended up talking to my mother. It's like, you have to see this thing. You have to see this. And sure enough, I put in the VHS tape again. Everybody enjoys the hell out of it. And literally, it kept like domino effects until we finally reached my father in this one as well. Like, every single time, this film worked and played like gangbusters amongst my family. None of whom were guaranteed to like this thing at all. I figured I had a better than average shot with my brother. Didn't count on anybody else. And that made a lifelong fan out of me out of it. But if you haven't ever seen any of Mystery Science Theater 3000, this is the place to start.
Yeah, because I haven't seen much of it. Again, I think a lot of that was sort of before my time. Or, I mean, I know that Mystery Science Theater has run in a couple different iterations, sort of different casts than that, and you know, as an older person, I understand a bit more what it is. As a kid, though, I remember seeing the trailer for Mystery Science Theater the movie and being so completely confused as to what this even was, or why all these old nerdy guys who lived in my small town were so pumped for it.
Yeah, and it's the thing. I mean, it barely saw theatrical release because basically the studio at the time pretty much abandoned it after. It's like, yeah, we're going to make this a big, huge hit. Ah, to hell with it. That would take too much time and money to actually sell this thing. Which is unfortunate because it really is, you know, it's definitely, for anybody who knows their MST3K, this is the era after its original creator and host Joel Hodgson had left, and we're very much in the Mike Nelson years. Like I said, I love all three of the hosts we've had, and I'm looking forward to our fourth host that's going to be joining for the upcoming new season as well. But like I said, this is kind of a perfect distillation of what it is. It's a film that's not so bad and painfully made as to be unwatchable there. Because, like, I mean, literally watching certain films that they've covered on the show, Manos, The Hands of Fate being probably the go-to example. You know, that's a bad movie on even just a technical level. This Island Earth is great, glorious, goofy 1950s science fiction in the best possible way, which makes it, you know, a visually a splendor to watch and provides plenty of opportunities for riffing. And I'm not going to lie, there are very few days that go by where I have not used the quote, "Hello, magic plane person," whenever I enter a house that I am reasonably sure is empty. So
if it helps, I'm not even that big of a serious fan, but probably once a month I find myself humming, "He tried to kill me with a forklift."
Yeah. God bless that.
The things you take with you, right? Yeah. And I guess if I'm being honest, this is another thing that we've covered as my third selection. But it's true, because as we've discussed, William Levinson and Lynx Columbo. Yes. It is more than a TV show, maybe a bit less than a film, and yet that is something I am always in the mood for, except for that one episode that was directed by Patrick McGoohan, where the reveal takes forever and makes no sense. But the fact is, if you're producing like 75 TV movies, they're not all going to be exactly A tier. But at the same time, like, again, there's sentimental reasons because, you know, I watch Columbo with my kids and we wind through the facts of the case and everything afterwards. But, you know, there is something just so comfortably pulp about it, and there is something so satisfying about, like, the golden age of television, and, you know, the fact that you could, it's proof positive that something can be formulaic without being stale, and, you know, every now and then you end up getting an absolute cracker that you don't see coming. Like the one with Lawrence Harvey as the deaf chess master is pretty remarkable. Any of the ones where Robert Culp is in it, not only is he tremendous, but like they usually do some really interesting formal things. Like I think it's the second episode where he commits a murder, and then it basically just shows the aftermath and the cleanup through reflections on
The
his own
glasses.
glasses.
Yeah.
More recently, I watched the one with Leonard Nimoy as the surgeon who successfully patched up his supervising doctor's heart but used dissolving sutures. And I remember when we put that one on, my daughter actually was thrilled because she says, oh, I've seen a clip from this one. It's the one time that Columbo's ever gotten angry at a suspect. And I'm like, oh, it's just there. I think it's also the fact that there are plenty of hard-nosed detectives. There are plenty of goofball detectives. There are plenty of inspectors. And there are plenty of different policeman archetypes out there. And why I appreciate Lieutenant Columbo so much is that first and foremost, he is a good man that loves people. And whether it's in the form of him comforting someone that he knows to be innocent, or explaining why the frame-up evidence against them couldn't possibly make any sense, or whether he's talking to a young boy after discovering Anthony Zerbe's decapitated body about magic tricks, and like talking with that, it's like that Fred Rogers appeal where at no point do you ever get a sense that his interest and fascination in the people he's speaking with is ever forced. And I mean, say what you will about modern policing. I got a lot to say about modern policing. I'm not going to pretend that your average beat cop has the heart of Columbo beating within. But again, there is something very comforting to me that, especially in difficult times, put on an episode of Columbo and you actually do believe in goodness and justice once anew.
On a related note, since we're opening up the door to television, there's no way in hell I couldn't include what I'm about to say, and it's already come up in this episode previously anyway. So, Doctor Who. Let's just get
There
it
it
out of the
is.
way. Look, this is not something that I have childhood nostalgia for, like some things. Like, you could sit there and say my love of Tales from the Crypt goes back to my childhood. Yes, I stayed up till midnight on Saturdays to watch it. You could talk the same thing with the X-Files or Star Trek even. Doctor Who was something that outside of my first viewing it in 1996 as the made-for-TV movie when it aired on Fox, I really didn't explore until 2005 with the revival when it came up. And I have got to say, I do not regret making the choice at all to go exploring the show. Because really, in many ways, this is kind of my perfect television show in terms of its sort of central ethos in this way. Because this is very much a show that is more than anything else, really just boils down to somebody traveling around trying to do the right thing, many times screwing up and many times getting it right in the process there. And the idea of, like nobody, one of the big things I love about this, and one of the problems I have with, let's take Star Trek, for example, there. One of my things, I love Star Trek. I very much love it. But one of the things that always irked me about it from time to time is the sort of Roddenberry cult, as I will refer to it, that really sort of, became cemented in the early seasons of The Next Generation, where Starfleet is innately good and always does the right thing, and nothing bad can possibly come from it in any way, shape, or form. No, I really don't buy into that mindset. And the beauty of, again, Doctor Who is that it is much like your Columbo here, it's about one person who honestly just goes about trying to do the right thing and gets called out on their BS when they make mistakes. And they do make mistakes throughout the course of the show. And I mean, there's so much mythology, there's so much building, and again, even just the simplicity of certain elements of it there, where, again, number one, is it a science fiction show? Well, not really. Is it a science is it a fantasy show? Well, not really. Science fantasy probably covers it, because it's not quite, this is not hard sci-fi in the sense, like, Isaac Asimov would be blowing a gasket watching your average episode of this show here in this instance. But that's, it's a show that also willingly acknowledges its own ridiculousness, that willingly, you know, during the early years when, you know, they had basically no budget, was more than willing to bring, you know, bring up and have some fun with some of the absurdity of that as well over the course of it. And just simple things like, how do you keep a show running when your central actor's going to leave? Hands down, Doctor Who has to have the single best refresh replacement system in place for your lead character that any show has ever had.
Well, yeah, because isn't it that the Doctor is just an immortal traveler that can regenerate his form or her form, or basically it's a being that can sort of remodel itself on a whim?
Well, effectively, yeah. I mean, again, it offers up some complexities that have definitely been explored both in the show and in the subsequent spin-off media as well. But the idea that, yeah, the Doctor, when they are either mortally wounded or just get so old that their body begins breaking down, yeah, they regenerate. And effectively, this means that they become, they're still technically the same person. They have all the memories, all the experiences, but it's a brand new body and with its own tastes, idiosyncratic beliefs, its own sort of attitudes towards things and its own particular interests. So you'll get things where suddenly the Doctor has gone from, yep, I like, you know, I could shuffle cards like nobody's business, to suddenly realizing, nope, that doesn't work anymore. Or realizing it's like, you know, I love apples. They're wonderful. They're delicious. Absolutely hates them now with a thriving passion. But again, the central ethos of the show, and again, I know people have things that they will say about Stephen Moffat and, you know, some of his, you know, decisions he makes with writing. I get it. But hands down, when it comes to the very central notion of the character, particularly in his very last episode, he basically, the final lines he gives Peter Capaldi's incarnation is pretty much the central ethos that I love of the show, which is try to be nice, never fail to be kind. And that is the fundamental principle of that show at the absolute heart of it, even in some of its darkest episodes. And I cannot help but be 100% on board with that. So for my money, that's what it is. And yeah, the Daleks are cool. Deal with it, world.
But honestly, though, David, actually, because I know it's not that we've never talked about Doctor Who in our own lives and in our own friendship and that. But, you know, I guess it's sort of like, I think something that I really admire about you and has always kind of defined you as a person is that ethos. And sort of, it goes back to like, as Vonnegut said, damn it, you simply have to be kind. And it's just, there's that idea that things that are our favorites, whether it's Columbo, Doctor Who, Kurt Vonnegut novels, you know, comic books, things like that. It's, we often feel like there's a sense that you're supposed to grow out of them, or you're supposed to move to more complex things that show the world as a messy and chaotic place, or narratives that aren't easily resolvable, or, you know, heroes that are shades of gray and things like that. And while I'm not going to sit here and pretend that the world is an inherently just and merit-based place or anything like that, sometimes it really is that simple. And it's nice, actually, you know, sort of with a view to winding things down for this installment, it is very nice to take that time to remind yourself that, yeah, nobody is looking into your living room and then taking notes on if you chose a smart enough movie to watch in your downtime. You know, the idea that, oh, that's a guilty pleasure. Well, no, You shouldn't feel guilty about enjoying the things that you like. And obviously, I mean, if you're trying to hold yourself out as, say, a column writing movie critic or something like that, it's a little bit different. But in terms of just average day-to-day viewing, you really don't need to think much more beyond, do I like this? And personal story, though. I mean, if there's anything I learned from a lifetime ago when I pursued something of an education in film studies, you know, people think that you have to learn all these grandiose ideas before you can truly appreciate what a film is, or that you go through and, you know, by the time you're out, you'll only ever want to watch Bergman and nothing but. But, like, what I've always told people is that when anybody watches a movie, the first question they ask themselves is, did I like that? And all I really kind of got from film studies beyond that, the only thing that separates the critic from the casual viewer is asking follow-up questions to that question of, did I like that? But I mean, you can't go wrong if you're answering yes to that first question. And if you're not answering yes to it, then you just gotta ask yourself, well, why waste your time with something that you don't like when you can be watching something that you do? Because again, like, I'm not going to pretend that putting on your favorite movie is going to turn your whole life around, but it's nice to remember that there are things about this world of ours and about this incredibly diverse and rapidly changing media object system that is film. You know, there's a reason that we're drawn to it in the first place, and by having a clear sense of your faves, that helps you remember what that reason is. And you know, it's been a very long time since my parents took me as an infant to the drive-in where Tim Burton's Batman 89 was playing, and when Jack Nicholson smashed the mirror, I started screaming so loud that we had to go home. That is my first memory of seeing a film in theater or on the big screen and that. And well, I'm still here now, so I guess it's true what they say. I'm trying to think of some kind of expression about movies. Dave, I'm dying here. Help me out.
Insert John Landis joke. But yeah, it was that or start singing the Tiny Little Speck song from Animaniacs. We'll avoid that for now since nobody needs to listen to my singing voice.
Nobody
But
needs to,
yes.
but they might want to.
Nah, I think we're pretty safe on that one.
Next time we need to stall for time for a bonus episode, I promise.
Indeed. But speaking of that, yes, so we will probably be back next week with a bonus episode. I won't say what exact one it is, only because I'm not 100% sure what that is yet. But it is coming, folks. Be sure about that. But until then, Andrew, let's just say people wanted to contact you. Where could they do so?
You can find me over on Twitter at FilmStripper. You can also find me monitoring the show email. Thank you, Resnick73. The answer is blue. You can email that over at filmstripspodcast@gmail.com. Dave, what about yourself?
In this point, if anybody would like to reach me, you can find me at 24 Panels Online. Always happy to have a civil conversation, which is about the extent of saying that, you know, please just don't come in angry. It'll be fine. But let's just say people wanted to leave long-form criticism to us, Andrew, in a form that may or may, you know, help boost us up on the charts, allow people to help find the show. Where can they do that?
I mean, we're probably less interested in the chase these days, but if you do want to remind us that yes, it's a competitive market out there, head on over to iTunes or whatever podcatching service you use and rate and review us. Obviously, 5-star reviews help move us up the featured chart, get new eyes and ears onto our show, but really the important part is that's where you can leave us some feedback. You know, it's been 3 interesting years that have seen a lot of ups, lots of downs, a lot of good movies, and a lot of bad ones. And all David and I have ever wanted to do is just bring those who tune in a show that they want to listen to. So let us know what's working, what ain't, and you know, We're cool guys. We can bend around it. And if we can't, we'll break trying.
So until then, Andrew, do you have any parting words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Yes, David, I do. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Naomi Harris for the 14th slash with the asterisk, 15th Doctor. Bye.
One day you'll find your ideal listener.